Welcome to the latest Open Door, Open City podcast. I'm Karina Robinson, co-director of the Inclusion Initiative with my colleague, Professor Grace Lorden. Our research centre at the LSE uses behavioural science and data to help create inclusive cultures in business, and not least in the city. Now, a few housekeeping bits and pieces. Follow us on Twitter at LSE_TII. Sign up to our newsletter. All of this is actually going to be in the chat box. And if you have any questions, please put them in the chat box as well. We're very lucky to have as our guest, Julia Hoggett, CEO of the London Stock Exchange. And she is a woman who's been a great campaigner for LGBT plus rights, turned the Stock Exchange into the place for ESG. Controversial at the moment, Julia, but we'll be talking about that. And a woman with one hell of a challenge. And this is something that her predecessors have also had, which is, how do you compete with the deep pools of capital in the US? We're going to talk about all of these issues over the next 45 minutes. But I'd like to start, Julia, with what you've done since you joined in 2021, which is about overhauling the London Stock Exchange. If I look at where it is now as an organization and where it was, it's changed immensely. And I feel that a lot of people out there, even in the investor community, aren't really aware of it. Could you just talk us through your program of change?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for having me. And sorry, I was late. It was entirely technical gremlins. So I think we need to talk about this in two stages. So the first is the evolution of LSEG as an organization. And the next is the evolution of the London Stock Exchange, of which we're part of LSEG. So well before my time, David Schwimmer came on board as the CEO of LSEG, the group. And in the time since he's been in place, which is sort of 5 years now, we have transformed the organization and its footprint. The most transformative piece of that was the acquisition of Refinitiv. And so you're bringing together a stock exchange, the heft of the FX platforms that Refinitiv had. You have Turquoise, we have a significant stake in Tradeweb, which is obviously one of the most significant fixed income trading players. So from a capital markets point of view, we are now as complete a package as we can be. We obviously have the post-trade activities in the London Clearing House and Univista, and we have all of the data and analytics capabilities of the Heritage Refinitiv business and the FTSE Russell business combined. So that makes us multifaceted and global in a way that a historical focus on the London Stock Exchange and the vertical integration of the activity around clearing of that was less so. It also gives us heft. So we're, depending on the day of the week, easily a top of FTSE 20 company. And that gives us an ability to think about our footprint in the world in a very different way. The history, and this will be in the, it is in the public domain, quite a lot of the history of stock exchanges over the last 20 years have been about the consolidation of stock exchanges, one acquiring the other. And indeed, London's maintaining its independence has been something of a storied history. The benefit of the heft of the group we have now is we can genuinely focus on our day jobs in the go forward, because we are big, we are hefty, arguably quite hard to swallow, and therefore we can focus on getting on with what matters to us. But I think the breadth of the organization as well expands your horizons and enables you to come out of the legacy of this is what we always used to do, and therefore what we want to do is just more of it, into really rethinking the way we think about it. I was asked once, how would you characterize the rationale for the LSEG Refinitiv merger? And I said, well, I can give you a flippant answer, which is that money makes the world go round and data shows it where to go. But that is actually the case. And the nature of the data that will inform where money flows going forwards is changing, and it's changing right now in front of our eyes. ESG being a prime example, which we can come onto, in terms of the way people need to understand the climate impact of a company as much as the net present value of its future cash flows. You know, so that shift is already taking place. What that has done for the London Stock Exchange, I think, is a different thing, which is the ability to say, okay, let's have an equally first principles, what is our purpose, relook at what we're there to do. And I say repeatedly, in fact, I said in a very public speech this morning, we are conveners of capital. Our job is to bring together those who have capital with those who need capital in service of an objective. that's one of the quickest ways you get to the importance of sustainability, because one of the most important objectives of our lifetimes is the just transition to net zero. But arguably, it also applies to where and who you provide capital for. We are a venue, we're a convening power. And you could say our role is just to do it in the public listed markets. But fundamentally, the way I think about it is, if your job is as a convener of capital, and capital is required across the funding continuum, across the value chain, then why shouldn't we be thinking about our role as much more expansive? So we have deliberately over the last year set ourselves the target of being the first global exchange group in the world that is genuinely indifferent as to whether a company is public or private. There is a need for a much better ecosystem in the private market space, making it much more possible for companies to find the financing. There is the need to get rid of all these cliff edge effects of moving between markets, and to make the transition work for the way companies actually operate today. And so those are two of the biggest things that we have shifted in terms of the aspiration for the stock exchange over the last year.
Tell me a bit more about the private, the idea of the private, because, you know, at the moment I'm involved with a company and it's in deep tech, we're raising money, private money. And then we're looking in the quantum world, we're looking at the number of companies that went with a SPAC and are now having terrible problems. And one of the bits of advice that I remember somebody giving our company was, stay private as long as possible. It's an easier journey, it's a more long-term journey, because public markets are just not the right place for deep tech, for instance. What are your views on that?
Well, I understand entirely why you were given that advice. I don't think it should be thus, but I think there is a different, so there's multifaceted answer to that question. The first point I think is, we kind of think of things as binary, either public or private. The reality is, if you look at the scale of capital that is in the public markets, it is huge. If you look at the scale of capital that's in the private markets, it is huge. It's not going away. And it's not a pure function of interest rates either. I don't view the heft that the private markets now have as being something that is going to change in this interest rate cycle. I think this is the way we live. And it, for good reason, it is creating the capability of providing that seed financing and that scale-up financing for the companies that are solving the problems of tomorrow. Now, the caveat I would put is, we should not think that the public markets are not capable of doing that. So there are changes that need to happen in the public markets to make sure that they are just as capable of doing it, possibly at greater scale, but just as capable of doing it. But my view, and the reason why we want to be a venue that is genuinely different, but providing venue mechanisms, convening mechanisms in each of these spaces, is because they are valuable places for companies to operate and fund and finance themselves in their own right, rather than just as an inevitable pathway. And it goes to the point of, if you are myopically tiny about what you think your job is, then the reason a stock exchange should be interested in a private company is it might IPO one day. If actually you think your purpose is to facilitate those who need capital connecting with those who have capital, then you're actually indifferent, so long as you're doing that, where on that value chain a company sits. And then the most important thing is, what is the right course for course, as it were? What, at what stage in your life cycle as a company should you be in? And one of the reasons I was talking about the cliff edge effects is, these are big gaps right now. And if you look at the way financial services work, there are very few things in common between the way the private markets work and the way the public markets work. You know, I often say, we don't use the same language, we don't use the same processes, we don't use the same systems, it's very different people. And often the only thing in common going through that process is the company itself. That shouldn't be the case. We should create a funding continuum and a much more kind of straightforward ecosystem for companies to operate across the scale. That's my vision. We started to put our money where our mouth is in doing that, but it changes what you think your job is as a stock exchange.
Now, I want to go a bit more into sustainability and responsible investing. And there was something that came out the other day, a few months ago. We are delighted to announce that the London Stock Exchange won Exchange of the Year at this year's Sustainable Bond Awards from some company or a magazine called Environmental Finance.
Yep.
The sustainable bond market has now raised over 142 billion US. That is a serious amount of money, and it's a serious amount of help in our transition. But there's been a backlash against ESG. And there was a chap at HSBC, Stuart Kirk, who came out at Davos with something that a lot of people might be thinking. And on the back of that, other people jumped on the bandwagon, which was A, we're taking the environmental cataclysm that is going to happen too seriously, that there are ways out of it, and B, that there's a lot of greenwashing out there, a lot of saying this or this is sustainable, but actually when you start looking at it, it turns out that it's not sustainable, not environmentally friendly. And I know there was, there's just been a police raid at DWS, which is Deutsche Bank's sort of asset management arm, looking at how they've been classifying some of their assets. Now, you know, this is a negative in some ways. We shouldn't take ESG, or especially the environmental part, really, which is what they're focused on, less seriously. But I mean, is it just a sort of growing up of the market? What's your view of what's been happening lately?
I think there are two issues. One is, how important is climate change, and what role does the financial services industry have in addressing it? And the other is, how do we do that safely? So we as an organization are very, very clear. We think that the transition to net zero is the greatest challenge of our generation. And we have a duty to future generations to make sure we do everything we can to drive it. And the reality is, it means driving capital flows in service of that objective. If you talk about, and you talked about the sustainable bond market, one of the things that is different about the way the London Stock Exchange thinks about its sustainability offering compared to other stock exchanges is because we are a multi-asset venue, we're a huge equity listing market, huge fund market, huge debt market, we don't just think of it as the bond market. We have a green economy mark for our equity issuers, where more than 50% of their revenues are coming from the green economy. A huge amount of the next generation and education technology in green finance in this country gets financed in the fund market. It's fund managers who understand that technology, getting equity support and equity capital support in order to invest in that, and often on a portfolio approach, diversify exposure. So we are already, our markets are already engineered to be able to have the capability to do this. The challenge we've had in the past, and I'm guilty of it because I set up one of the first dedicated sustainable bond markets, bond businesses in the city, is it's a very small part of the total capital flows. The absolute amount of what's gone into the sustainable bond market versus what flows through the bond market every day, or the total amount of companies that have got our green economy mark versus what trades on the FTSE every day, is kind of pretty small. And actually, this is about how we change the way we think about value. So we, as I have said, we have a market that is traditionally focused on how you understand the net present value of future cash flows. Now, the actual aspiration going forward is that we have a market that understands the net present value of future cash flows adjusted for their impact on the planet. Because that's how you both get to net zero and stay there. And it is about, in the same way that we think about technology now as just embedded in what we do. You know, if you're running an organization like mine, you can't pretend that technology is somebody else's problem. You have to be au fait with it, you have to know how to use it, and you have to think about strategizing and building it. And the simple reality is that understanding the impact on the planet of your daily activities should be something that is done exactly that way. There will be teething pains in terms of how we get there. I don't think of it as either or. People set this up as a binary thing. It's only binary if you've got a really short-term horizon. It's not binary if you've got a long-term investment horizon. And so it's really about how we make the mechanisms that exist, that currently exist in audit functions and accounting rules and listing rules and transparency rules and the market abuse regime and the data that goes through the pipes and how people think about indexes, and convert that to have the same ability to assess the net present value on the future of the planet. And what I say on that regard is that we need to move to ESG as BAU. So ESG, rather as BAU. So as my colleagues say, eight letters and really difficult. But the task I have set people is, if in 2025 we wanted to say that when somebody traded a security or a product on the London Stock Exchange, they could understand it through the lens of its net present value and its impact on the planet, what would we need to do? What would that need to look like, and what needs to change from where we are today? Now, the UK is further ahead than most other countries in this regard. So listed companies already have to apply TCFD, Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure.
Thank you.
Yeah, Yeah, don't worry. I'm going to do the acronym translation. And from next year, companies will have to publish transition plans. So they have to set a target for when they want to get to net zero and then publish the route by which they'll get there. The consequence of that is we actually already have more of the information covered by standard disclosure rules and market abuse rules than most other countries do to get us there. But we'll also make mistakes along the way. The reality is some of the technology that we think is game changing today, we'll discover it isn't the technology we're relying on in 5 years' time. And therefore we can't reduce this to binary either ors or the simplification of a tweet, as it were. It actually has to be a capacity to have a nuanced conversation about the fact we will iterate and we will learn and we will make mistakes. Because if this was easy, mankind would have done it already, you know? And so it's a conversation.
That on the back of this, because as you're saying, the UK, you know, is in advance of some of the, you know, the requests it has for its public companies. And I just wonder if, you know, going back to that idea of we are always ultimately competing with the US and its deep pools of capital, you know, is this one of our USPs? And I'm going to explain USP, unique selling point, you know, because I mean, too many acronyms here. But is it what is going to help us compete?
It has the potential to be, and that's why the government has set the target of the city being the global centre for environmental finance and for sustainable finance. And look, we're seeking to do that in creating the voluntary carbon markets. So we are consulting at the moment on the first sort of global voluntary carbon market to direct financing into the projects that will ultimately give rise to a voluntary carbon credit. So it's to direct financing into the things on the ground that will either sequester or remove carbon from the atmosphere in a way that would not have been done on its own on purely commercial grounds. And so that is about, and there is that, it isn't Einstein, but that point about sign of madness being doing the same thing over and over and again, expecting a different result. Actually, some of this is changing the pipes of plumbing, you know? It's changing the way capital is naturally directed so that it can be directed as much in service of that objective as it can in service of identifying the thing that will generate the most net present value.
Transformation takes funds, it takes people. And if I think a headline I just read in the Standard last night, the value of London slopes falls by over 90% year on year. Mm-hmm. We've got interest rates. I mean, just today, two more interest rate rises announced. We've mm-hmm. got collapsing tech bubbles. We've got war. You know, it's not looking, and a number of companies are having to do what they call down rounds, which for those who are not in finance is about basically you're raising money. Even though your revenues are increasing and possibly your profits, you're having to raise money at a lower rate because people just aren't willing to pay. So yep. How badly do you think these, you know, rather, I don't know what a good word is for these markets, upsetting markets. For anybody who's got a pension, God, these are upsetting markets. How is this going to affect transformation and people's investing patterns and, you know, what do you see happening over the next few years?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And look, that dynamic that you referenced in the Standard is identical all over the world. And it's a function of two things. One is obviously the Ukraine war obviously caused people to put things on hold in the first instance. The growing pressure from an inflationary point of view brought the central banks into play to a considerably greater degree than might have been anticipated even in January. And that has caused a growth reset and therefore a valuation reset. Because obviously, if you think about value fundamentally as a net present value of future cash flows, your future cash flow expectations have changed. And so I think this is the other thing. We have kind of, over the years, got into the habit of up is good, down is bad, kind of, rather than recognizing, and I'm a former fixed income person. So, I mean, if something goes up in price or goes up in yield, it's not necessarily a good thing. I'm used to confusing senses of whether up or down is a good thing. But I think the reality is that these resets happen because external events have changed, the structure of the economy has changed, and our expectations have changed. And the market's most responsible thing is to respond to those and to price in those forward expectations. That is the market functioning. So when I was at the FCA as Director of Market Oversight, there were some calls at the beginning of COVID that the markets shouldn't be functioning. They should be shut. the serving no useful purpose was, I think, a comment that was made. My view was, as long as they are orderly, they should be open. And they were orderly, and therefore they were open, because they serve a vital purpose in responding to events, whether those events are causing valuations to go up or causing valuations to go down. We're not price regulators in this country. And therefore, to one degree, the key test of whether the market's serving its purpose is it responding rationally, and are those price indications moving rationally through the system? They will cause declines in asset valuations because of those changed forward expectations. And the broadest context is, I started saying in about 2010 that we have never pumped so much money into the system, and therefore, by definition, we've never taken so much money out of it. That was an accurate statement in 2010. It's been accurate every year since, until just now, where you're starting to see bond buying programs and central bank balance sheets start having to come in. What this is, as a former regulator, what I reflect on is there are people who are now VPs, possibly even MDs, trading fixed income in this country, who haven't seen rates go up. Well, not really. So that is a really interesting illustration of the length of the cycle that we've been through. But what the market is doing right now is entirely rational in the context of the cycle that we've been through. And you will see resets and you will see revaluations. And there is a question as to whether certain markets sort of might have got overvalued, and then this is a bigger reset as a consequence. It was ever thus, I think. So this is a rational function to me of the wider context that we're in. And one of the things that the market usually is, and I stand on the balcony for market closes, and we observe all the closing auction in these remarkable visuals. And you can look at it and go, well, that's the market being rational. You know, and sometimes it's uncomfortably rational. You know, there are days when you see trading activity at the start of the Ukraine war, and you see who's up and who's down. And you saw, for example, those in the extractive industries and those in raw commodities doing very well. And you thought, that's the uncomfortable truth about this really horrendous situation. But that's what markets do. And that's what they should be expected to do, in a way.
But, you know, the market is rational. It's not always entirely rational. I mean, it does. The pendulum does swing too far each way.
It can do, and that's my point. Yeah.
When you look, though, government also has an effect on markets. And I know you're apolitical, okay? So if I sit here, Julia, and I criticise the government, it has nothing to do with you. There's a bit of an issue with, and one understands that electors matter, but the government does not seem to be in love with us in the city or in business. I don't expect it to be in love with us, but at least it should like us a bit more. If I think about the city, we still bring in around 10% of the tax revenues for this country. That's a lot of hospitals. You know, that's a lot of schools. And the government, we get very mixed signals from them. We get some interesting things happening in terms of reform. What I'd like to ask you in a very apolitical way is, what do you think is being done right and is helping you with capital markets reform and let's say the political atmosphere? And what, rather than being negative and saying what's being done wrong, what might be on your shopping list?
I've got a very long shopping list, but then government knows that. So I think, let me try and kind of reflect what it felt like as a regulator. So one of the challenges of the last many years, as a consequence of the Brexit vote, and I think one of the things that was sort of underestimated, was the sheer heavy lifting involved in executing Brexit. The actual job, even in financial services, of translating the EU regulatory set into domestic rules, what was called a lift and shift, okay? That lift was very heavy, very complicated, and took a lot of people to do. And it didn't leave the space for change in those circumstances. So it created an environment where the activity was to safely deliver Brexit. It didn't create the space to go, right, what do we need to fix and where do we need to go now? Actually, what's happened subsequently is that is exactly the question and the conversation that is happening. The speech I was giving this morning is on the evolution of the listing regime in the UK and the regulator, the government's reviews, the chairman of the FRC, CEO of the LSE are all standing up and saying, fundamentally, this is the opportunity to create the markets that drive our economy for the next 30 years. And here are our objectives, and this is what it's for. And one of the things I think we don't do very well in the city, and I will say this repeatedly, is we're really bad at talking about our purpose, you know? And very often we talk about it in very self-referential ways, which is this will help the city. Now, I work in the city, I've worked in the city my entire career. We work with the city and we will do everything we can to serve the city. But fundamentally, I view the London Stock Exchange as having the core desire to be a driver of the UK domestic economy and a driver of the UK's place as a global financial centre. And I want anybody in this country to care that we have a vibrant capital market in this country. It should matter to them. And when we think about the way we frame it, and this was a comment I made in the speech this morning, there was a heckler during the Brexit debates who, when there was a macroeconomist who was standing up somewhere in, I think, Newcastle and saying, this is the potential impact on GDP, the heckler said, that's your bloody GDP, not mine. Now, the reality is it's all of us. But if we talk in exclusionary language about financial services and about the city, and we talk in a too self-referential way, then the financing that creates a British vault factory in Cumbria that means that there are kids for generations to come who are going to have jobs in places that they might otherwise have to leave, but they can stay living with their family and their families have got the confidence that they've got a future career. The fishing industry in Grimsby that's being retooled into the fundamental support industry for the offshore wind farms, for example. These are things that finance and the city are there to enable. That's the greatest value, and that's what we need to ensure we're talking about. And when you talk to government about the city through that lens, they engage very, very differently.
Because we need to change how we communicate.
We need to change the narrative.
Yeah, and narrative.
Also celebrate success. You know, we need to be able to recognize that people who put their own money and their own mortgage and sometimes their marriage on the line to back a good idea and turn it into reality actually deserve to be celebrated. And sometimes those things will fail. But the world is run and driven by the people who will pick themselves up again, dust themselves off and do it again. And creating that opportunity to really support and enable that to thrive, to create the environment where it's supported the best and then celebrated, gives people the sense that actually they can, anything's possible. You know, and that's where the conversation about what the markets do needs to change, I think. And I think as an industry, we've not been very good at doing that at any point in the 25 years I've been working in it, if I'm honest.
Now, you know, when we talk about communication, there was something you said at the Innovate Finance Global Summit, which is a narrative, you know, and it is something that obviously you got a bit of a backlash on, and I'll tell viewers exactly what this was, but it's a difficult thing to say. So basically, speaking at the Innovate Finance Global Summit, you said the UK needed to have a grown-up conversation about the remuneration of executives if it was going to tempt firms to do business here. Basically, pay people more. You tell somebody out in Grimsby that we need, okay, you could argue with me, but that we need to have a grown-up conversation about potentially paying people more in the city or in corporates. That won't go down well.
Look, in an inflationary environment as it is, it absolutely matters that we care about the ability to support and have a living wage for absolutely everybody. There's no issue about that. The issue is about recognizing how we maintain the maximum potential for, and the way I describe it is, how do we create the best possible environment for really good companies to start here, grow here, scale here, and stay here? The risk we have is we've got two of the top five universities in the world, and I'm talking to another one which should be in the top five. We create a unicorn every 27 days in this country. And yet 60% of the venture capital that finances UK corporates is coming from, or UK companies, is coming from overseas. And we've got less than 4% of the listed market. So we have all this potential, which we create and we start, which could redound to the very people in Grimsby who actually want good high paying jobs. And then we export it. And some of the reason we do is we don't maintain the incentives for those companies to stay here. And so if you think about that phrase I use, it's very deliberate. I don't use list here at all. It's stay here. Because that creates the IP, it creates the tax revenue, that pays for the schools, it pays for the hospitals, and it enables us to create an ecosystem that enables us to drive high growth and productivity, which should redound to everybody. It's not a trickle-down logic. It's fundamentally a dynamism logic. And one of the things we don't do as well as we could is harness all of that remarkable potential that we create to continue to deliver for the economy. That's the argument. And the comp bit is, if you're going to lose a really good fintech to the US because they're going to relocate there, because the CEO feels they're going to get fewer brickbats for getting rewarded for the fact they created something that was worth nothing when they put their house against it and is now worth $5 billion. And because they can pay themselves a portion of that whilst paying their staff really well, paying their taxes on time, doing everything else they need to do, and it's better that they move to the US to do it, well, all those taxes are going to the US as well. That's the conversation. So the way, I mean, I said it again today. I said it in a slightly different way, but I said exactly what I said. What was reported and what I'd actually said out loud weren't quite the same thing as ever. But the point is that if we want to say that the UK wants to work on a quantum or whatever in terms of total company, I understand all of those things. I really do. We need to have a grown-up conversation about what we gain and what we lose by doing those things. And that's the conversation. If we consciously choose to say that the UK is not going to offer those upsides for entrepreneurs and founders in the way that another country is, then we need to be conscious about the recognition that some of those may choose to locate elsewhere, take their IP elsewhere, and take their future tax revenue elsewhere. Now, if the country chooses to do that, that's a conscious choice, but it should be a conscious choice. And that's really what I was trying to say.
The problem in the world we live in is that if there's nuance, it never comes through, does it? Never comes through.
Journalist connected what I'd said to Bankers Pay. I didn't mention Bankers Pay once. So
now, one of the things about making sure we have the best companies in the world is that you have got to have a bigger talent pool and a more inclusive talent pool. And that's always been the argument I've used in all the companies I've been involved in, is why are we ensuring that we don't have anybody who looks different to you, my CEO, because that's basically what you do unless you're out there creating more inclusive cultures. So at the NSE, what do you think you've, and obviously it was on a transformation journey anyway, but how have you put in a few changes that have really had an effect in terms of recruiting talent in what is a global talent war?
Well, I think the LSEG as an organization was on the journey before I arrived. And for me, I wouldn't have wanted to join an organization that I didn't think thought the same way that I do about the importance of diversity and inclusion. And I think you need to deliberately separate those two words out and treat them as two separate things. And what I love is that I'm given a complete platform to make all the points that I want to make in this space regularly. Let me give you a bit of perspective on how I think this conversation has evolved over the last 20 years that I've been very publicly talking about it in the city. I came out 2 years into my career. So I was one of the first openly gay women on trading floors in the city. And I actually got involved in organizing recruiting events for LGBT people for the city very, very early on. In fact, before they became a much more standard thing than they are today. Sufficiently so that got press coverage, it got radio coverage, it was a big, scary, wow, this is crikey kind of thing. And I went into some other firms, who investment banks, who invited me in afterwards to talk about the kind of journey we'd gone on as an investment bank to do this. And one of them, I remember to this day, said, I'm doing this in spite of my CEO rather than because of my CEO. They don't know you're here. No? And that was in an era where the importance of diversity and inclusion was not, I think, universally understood by senior leadership in the city and in Wall Street, et cetera. Come forward 10, 15 years when I'm not director of market oversight, but when I was head of investment banking supervision, one of the kind of joys of that job is you get to sit down with the CEOs of all the major investment banks on a pretty regular basis. I didn't meet one of them who wasn't passionate about diversity and inclusion. I couldn't really articulate the value for them. So say by 2014, 15, 16. What then happened is that over the few years after that, they realized that saying it out loud wasn't enough. You know, you actually, in order to change the actual numbers on the ground, you needed to do things differently. It goes back to the Einstein point. Now you do the same thing over and over again, expect a different result. And so now the hard work is really starting, which arguably should have happened years ago, which is how do you reorientate your perspective, your way of thinking, your meritocracies, your processes, what's expected around here, how we do things around here, to really create the most inclusive environment that you can. And again, we haven't got a rule book for this or a roadmap, because by definition, we haven't done it in society. And some of it starts on reframing. And you talked about people. And to me, one of the most important things is having a really detailed conversation about meritocracies. Because the way I talk about meritocracies are, meritocracies are very often mechanisms for rewarding the traits and characteristics of those who are already at the top. And then we surprise ourselves by the fact it produces exactly the same outcome every time. Well, funny that, because actually that's what it's designed to do. The problem with meritocracies on the basis is actually they're pernicious, because they do that whilst making us feel better about ourselves because we're running a meritocracy. That is a wonderful form of self-delusion. And I'll be provocative, and I have said this many times from many different podia, and nobody has shot me yet, but there is no empirical evidence that men dominating the upper echelons of the corporate world in this country produces the best results. It's not a feminist comment. It's not even a diversity and inclusion comment. It's a research methods comment. By definition, we've never had a control group to prove it. But we require more empirical evidence to change the status quo than we do to keep it. And as soon as you reframe the way we think about it through those just a small number of different lenses, then all of a sudden it gives you a window to unlock the processes that you need to change to be able to garner the benefit. I want to work in an organization where I'm creating an equal opportunity for everybody to thrive. Fundamentally, 99.5% of all the work I do through other people. If I've basically said, I'm only going to create an environment where 35% of the straight, let's say I have a population of 50-50 and I have 35% of my male colleagues are straight and white. I'm basically going to create an environment where 35% of my staff have an opportunity to thrive and everybody else is behind the eight ball. It's not logical. It's not logical in terms of making the most of the resources that you have in service of your purpose, you know? And so actually there is really hard work to do on making sure that we as employers and as leaders create environments where everybody has an equal opportunity to thrive and we get the best out of all of our people. And that's the conundrum, but it needs you to reframe the fact that actually everybody does have an equal opportunity to thrive and everybody can contribute. And so you need to throw off those lazy assumptions that a leader looks like X, or a person in that seat looks like Y, or a person in that seat has a history of that or whatever else. I'll stop ranting on for hours. But one of the final things I'd say is, please, can we have more people who didn't read finance wanting to go into finance? I'm a sociologist by training. I specialized in sub-Saharan East Africa. And at some point, I'll go back and do the thing I wanted to do when I grow up. You know, that's how I think about the world. It's useful to be a sociologist in dealing with markets, because markets are about how large groups of people think, you know, in reality. But I started my career with poets and historians and geographers and linguists. By the time I finished investment banking, everybody had read finance and decided they wanted to be an investment banker when they were 15 and done 18 summer internship programs and summer programs and spring programs and everything else. And I totally understand why the students are doing it, because they're being told that's exactly what you have to do. It's the industry that needs to change and say, we need polyglots. And we can teach people the finance bit. And if they've done some at university, that's utterly brilliant. But actually, we need people who've got a broader perspective and look out from behind their screens and look around about what they're actually doing it for.
And okay, so I'm going to stop your rant. No, I'm going to stop your rant, Julia, because otherwise we won't get to other questions. But I mean, I 100% agree. I wrote a piece for the FT about that, about how I read international relations, and now I'm in the quantum tech world. And we definitely need this cross-pollination is where you get brilliant new ideas coming up.
Exactly.
But one of the things that slightly disheartens me, and this is going slightly off message, but it was both you and I have been involved in a world that we're trying to ensure there is respect for every human being, whatever they are, and that they can not only do well in their personal life, but help the business world, the government world, the, you know, the economy, create jobs, create happy people. So it all sounds great. And the inclusion initiative, you know, on the back of what you've been saying, we've come up with frameworks to help middle managers actually create a more inclusive workplace. We've got executive education now, and it's all about making a better world. And I went out on Monday night, I went out to dinner with a 24-year-old graduate from an, let's just say Oxbridge, a young man. And he happened to have spent the weekend with some friends of his, female friends of his, also Oxbridge, and I'm trying not to be too specific, who are in the city. Mm-hmm. So sexism, people making passes at them, going out for a team dinner of 12 where the boss says to the Oxbridge graduate who is female, who we don't need to say she's bright, do we, or committed, but obviously I feel we almost need to, because what did he say to her? He said, yeah, I can visit you living in Chelsea with a rich banker husband. Okay, so Julia, and then you get Aviva, the CEO of Aviva being asked, so why don't you wear trousers? I don't know, Julia, are we just wasting our time?
No, in short, I hear you, and I think if there's a crumb of comfort in anything you've just said, and there isn't much, and I appreciate it, it's how shocking those things are now compared to how commonplace they were in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s. Okay. And I think we need to retain that shock and that disgust, frankly. And I think we also need to be putting the onus much more on the allies in the room to be calling out that behavior. So one of the frustrations of the way the diversity and inclusion agenda works in general is almost always we put the onus on those who are being excluded to justify their right to be included. We don't put the onus on those doing the excluding to justify their exclusion, their right to exclude. And I think there's an awful lot of people who were asked by their organizations to talk about their experience in the context of George Floyd, who, to be blunt, said, how many more times do you need to hear my pain so that you can feel better about yourself? And that is part of that. We have to recognize that. But I think it requires us to put ahead about the parapet. I mean, I don't think that because I've got to this seat, my job is to shut up about this stuff. It's to keep talking about it. And it's to use my privilege to call it out and to make sure I haven't pulled the drawbridge up and I make it easier for those who come after me. And I mean, I have come from an organization where we used to look at what I describe as the lived experience and the perceived experience of different populations within the organization. So you do your staff survey and you'd understand the diversity characteristics of the people doing the survey. And then you'd understand, okay, well, how do the general population feel about somebody, what it's likely to be like to be gay in this organization versus how do the gay people feel? Now, statistically, as an openly gay senior woman, I was about the happiest person in the building. No. But the perception from colleagues was that it was harder to be gay than actually the gay people in the organisation thought it was. However, for those from an ethnic minority with disabilities, it was very much the other way around. So that tells you that's where you need to use your privilege to focus on changing the experience of those parts of the organisation and being prepared to talk about it and being prepared to, I mean, if I come back from an external meeting and I've been mansplained, I will say so to my executive. My next leadership team, I'll say, well, that was fun because I got mansplained there.
Can you explain what that is to our audience?
It is the occasion when some men, and by no means all at all, feel the need to talk down and explain something to women because they might not want to have worried their pretty little heads about it. I'm paraphrasing, but, and even I get that. I had my own business model mansplained to me over a dinner at Mansion House once by someone who said, well, I'm a former investment banker, I can tell you this. And I was like, well, I run the organization, I think I can tell you how my P&L works. I didn't say that. I just listened and then disabused them of the assumptions they made. But it still happens to me. It's certainly still happened to Amanda Bynes. But you can do two things. You can wither under the weight of it, or you can do what Amanda did, which is have an ally in the room who stood up in the moment and called it out, and deliberately called it out, which
that's
I think is essential.
Her chairman, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then you can talk about it and own that narrative and make change on the back of it. And I think that's the model. And it's an incrementalist model. And the world isn't going to be perfect overnight. And when we resolve perceptions of one thing, we will find something else where there is stigma or attitudes that don't create that equal opportunity for people to thrive. But we just need to keep working at it, because change is profound already.
One of the interesting things that came up, in fact, last week, I gave a keynote at something called the Age Diversity Forum, and it was about age. We don't think of age as sort of, as you will, as a sort of impediment, but of course it is, because we live in a tech world, we live in a world where the idea is generally you're over 50, maybe you need to be, you know, start being on the way out here. And yet, as you've just said, in terms of you studied sociology, you're now the CEO of the London Stock Exchange. It's all about getting diverse minds and diverse views in the room. I think we waste a lot of older people. And I say this as someone who's 58 and I'm an older person now. How can we, especially, and again, you know, let's bring it down to the bottom line. We don't have enough talent coming in or staying in, and how can we change the narrative around age to make sure we have access and we keep people in organizations and hire others who have different experiences, who might be over 50, but say, not, well, you're on your way out, what about come in and help us do something different?
Well, I think it's critical, but I mean, I heard a stat, I think it was yesterday, that For the cohort born in the sort of 1970s, 1980s, a very large number will live to 100 and will work for 60 years. You know, it's very different from the assumption that people sort of start at 20 and finish at, and in some cases, 55 and then edge out. It's a very different world. And so this is increasingly a reality we will have to grapple with and change and adapt to. There are parallels, though. The other thing I'd say before I get onto the parallels is that cohort you're talking about is also the one that has been stepping out of the labor force almost just at the time we need them the most over the course of the last 2-3 years, which I think is going to create a tension in solving the problem, which might actually be valuable. But the broader point for me is a lot of our challenges around how we keep populations of any description, be they older people or actually working mothers as another example, is because we say, this is how you have to show up when you work. These are the rules of the game. They operate between these times, these frames. You need to look like this, talk like this, sound like this, do this. What COVID has taught people is that's not actually the case. We're doing this entirely remotely. 5 years ago, it wouldn't have occurred to us that this was possible in anything other than a sit-down face-to-face event. You know? It just wouldn't. And so that reality has shifted radically. How do you create multiple different pathways where people can contribute in organizations, where their structures of their life can be matted in? How do you create structures where people, for example, in their 70s are contributing to an organization, say 2 or 3 days a week, or in blocks of time or something else, rather than you have to rock up and do this and do this and do this? I think we will evolve to that over time. And I think we need to just find the ways and break down those barriers and assumptions. When I was a regulator, and we did quite a lot of work on this, quite regularly firms would use us as the excuse. Oh, we can't possibly introduce that flexibility because the regulation says X. And I used to have to stand up and give speeches and say, I don't know the regulation that says you can't do that. You know, I mean, I said the other day, and I was at a big ICMA conference in Vienna, I said, we've had trading books that follow the sun for time immemorial now. Why can't we have trading books that follow the school bell? There's no regulatory reason why not.
That's a great phrase.
But it's those kind of things that we need to think about and reframe. And sometimes it's just asking ourselves the question that we haven't asked ourselves before, and then giving ourselves permission that the answer might be different, you know, and it is doable. And I think that's how you create the structures of work that can keep people engaged in the manner that's best to enable them to contribute for the longest possible time. I think it is changing. I mean, I really do. I mean, there was a chap who was still going to work in a car factory in the Midlands, who I think was in his 90s or something. He'd had 60 years of continuous service or something. Nowadays, we actually know how to celebrate that and recognise it. And I think we need to get better at doing that. But it doesn't necessarily need to be the same service every day. You know, it needs to evolve. And we need to have, same way we have a third age now, we need the sort of fourth, fifth, sixth ages of work, I think.
Now, Julia, let me just take a question here. There's a very interesting question, which was...
very good question.
Yeah, quarter of businesses are led by women, yet they receive less than 5% of all equity funding. What should be done to help redress this balance? And what role can the London Stock Exchange Group play?
Well, the first is very noisy about that very fact. So I agree, and it's a very good question. And in fact, one role I'm playing is the minute I finish this, I've got to go downstairs and give a speech at the Stock Exchange on exactly this topic. So we actually create sprint environments for female-led businesses to find funding and to find the support that they need. And part of our role in trying to think about creating private ecosystems, intervening ecosystems, and the public ecosystem is how do we create what we describe as communities of interest. So how do we create venues where female entrepreneurs feel that's their space, where they can go and find the investors? How do we create venues where deep tech companies feel that's their space too? It can be exactly the same venue, but very often one of the challenges that you have for trying to engage with companies is that most companies' identity isn't bound up by the way they're financed. Most companies' identity is bound up by the thing that they do. And so for the regulator and for the exchange, the least clubbable group you deal with is the companies that are looking for the financing on your market. And therefore, making sure people really understand how to navigate the system, but also thinking about the user journey of the navigation of the system. And then doing everything you can to point out that actually there is no evidence that female-led businesses don't do as well than men. There's a lot of evidence that mixed businesses do incredibly well. But the percentage of capital they get is still much lower. Now, the data is being pumped out and reported and reminded to everybody a lot. There is a lot of work going on in the venture capital space. We are doing everything we can to amplify that message and think deliberately about the tools that we can use to direct capital into those spaces. But the first is to make as much of a venue and an easy using platform as possible for companies to find financing. Because then it's your results and your idea that win, not who you knew and who was in your Rolodex. You know, so it's very much about how you create that best possible environment. And one of the things I hope to be able to do over time is be able to measure what impact this has had on the access that women-led companies have had to financing. But it is a deliberate point, and we call it out at every moment. I'm afraid I would feel wrong in the things I've always done on from a D&I point of view if I didn't stand up and say these things. But you need to call it out and then do something about it.
Thank you, Julia. I mean, I have other questions, and others have sent me some privately, which they always do, which is irritating because we'd like them on the chat. But, you know, what you're doing is transforming an organization, which I think not enough people are aware of how much has been done, especially on the private side. And I think that's something we need to celebrate and get out there a lot more. And the fact that, you know, a diverse and inclusive workforce is more productive, and we're doing all the research we can to constantly bolster this. But you know, we've already got McKinsey, Harvard Business Review, they've all proved this already.
I treat conclusions like climate change. You know, we don't need to debate whether it's an issue, we just need to figure out how we fix it. So let's stop having the framing conversation, let's just get on with the doing.
Very good. I'm going to send you an email now, which is going to be about your handing over some money to the quantum world to help keep quantum companies in here. It ties in with everything that you've said. So you're going to say yes to my request for funds. But Julia, on a more serious note, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for everything you're doing on all fronts. And we hope to see you again soon. And for those of you who've tuned in, please do tune in also for our next podcast, which will be with General Ben Hodges. He was the head of the US Army in Europe. And he retired a couple of years ago, is now at a think tank, so he can talk quite publicly about things that he was saying then, including the fact that Russia, we shouldn't have taken our eyes off Russia. He was talking about that about 10 years ago. We were all obsessed with China. And the other point is about how inclusive the US Army is. It's not an obvious one, but actually, it really is a great place, and he will have some lessons to share with us soon. So thank you again to Julia and everybody who participated.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.